From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. This week, I've chosen three articles that have come out this past week that I think are particularly relevant for the practice of cardiovascular medicine. In one of them, we'll talk about stroke prevention for non-valvular atrial fibrillation. We'll talk about diastolic blood pressure and our targets for that, and whether going lower is safer or more risky. And then we're going to finish up with a very interesting article looking at infective endocarditis in patients with bicuspid aortic valve or mitral valve prolapse, which represents an area of ongoing controversy. So let's start with a wonderful perspective article looking at stroke prevention in non-valvular AFib. This was published in JACC just this past week. And it was a great review, and I thought you might enjoy getting just the highlights from it. Obviously, atrial fibrillation is hugely common. It's anticipated that more than 12 million Americans will have AFib by 2030. And of course, stroke is the most debilitating complication. This occurs in up to 125,000 Americans each year. If we look over the past decade to 15 years, the prevalence of AFib among patients who are admitted with an acute stroke has gone up from 16% to 20% by 2014. And you're all aware that AF-related strokes are more disabling. They tend to be larger, and they're more likely to recur. And of course, therefore, they're associated with a higher mortality. Obviously, stroke prevention with oral anticoagulation is a challenge. And it's still estimated that as many as 50% of high-risk patients are not receiving therapy. And we know that adherence to anticoagulants is often suboptimal, both with warfarin and with the direct oral anticoagulants. Obviously, there are a number of strategies now available to prevent stroke with AFib, including warfarin, the DOACs, antiplatelet therapy. Now we have the left atrial appendage occluder, or excision, both percutaneous and surgical. Obviously, warfarin's been around a long time, and it's highly effective. It's low cost, it's readily available, and we have an easy-to-administer antidote. But it's cumbersome to monitor, it has issues with drug-drug and drug-food interactions, which generally affect the quality of anticoagulation management. Over the past 10 years, the DOACs have emerged and now are thought to be first-line therapy in prevention of AF-related stroke for many patients. They're easy to use. They have a low risk of bleeding complications. But for some patients, insurance issues are important, and these drugs are so expensive they simply can't afford it. And an antidote is not universally available right now for the DOACs, although that is coming soon. Studies that have compared full anticoagulation versus antiplatelet therapy have generally shown that antiplatelet therapy is less effective for stroke prevention. Recently, the percutaneous left atrial appendage occluder with Watchman device has been shown to be non-inferior to warfarin for the reduction of all-cause stroke and systemic embolism. This is now FDA approved, and it's used in patients at increased risk of stroke who are really looking for a non-pharmacologic alternative to warfarin. Surveillance of outcomes has been mandated by CMS, and this is allowing us to track safety. Obviously, this is very effective for people who have recurrent bleeding on warfarin or one of the DOACs. Recall that the patients do need to be on antiplatelet drugs for a period of time after the Watchman is implanted, but then can go off. Certainly, some of my own patients have had very successful outcomes when they've had recurrent, particularly GI bleeding, that we could not seem to get around with anticoagulants. Surgical ligation of the left atrial appendage is now performed in patients who have AFib at the time of heart surgery. Please remember that some studies have found that this procedure is incomplete in up to 40% of the patients, and those patients can have left atrial appendage thrombus formation and ongoing stroke risk. The surgeon can do this either with a suture or with an external clip called an atriclip. One of the biggest issues we continue to have is the knowledge gap between patients' perception of their stroke risk and the risk-benefit trade-off of taking anticoagulation therapy. And study after study suggests that even patients at risk for falls, for example, still they're way better off if we treat them with anticoagulation. And this effort has to continue for both patients and providers alike. So a nice review on AFib in JACC, and I thought you would like the key points. Now I'm going to switch gears and talk about a paper that was published this week in the European Heart Journal. The title was Achieved Diastolic Blood Pressure and Pulse Pressure at Target Systolic Blood Pressures of 120 to 140, and Looking at Outcomes in High-Risk Patients. And this looked at data from the OnTarget and the Transcend clinical trials. This was an analysis looking at patients from these trials. They were 55 years of age or older. They had cardiovascular disease. They were on drug therapy, including ramipril or telmisartan or a combination. This particular study looked at patients who had what the investigators called controlled systolic blood pressure. That is, on treatment, their systolic pressure was in the 120 to 140 range. And then it looked at the composite outcome of cardiovascular death, MI, stroke, hospital admission for heart failure, and components of those, based on the diastolic readings that the patient had when their systolic was reasonably controlled. And the groups they looked at were less than 70 millimeters, 70 to 80 millimeters of mercury, 80 to 90, and greater than 90. The pulse pressure was also looked at. So the study included about 16,000 patients who had this systolic blood pressure achieved. The lowest risk for all outcomes, if the systolic pressure was good, was a diastolic pressure of 70 to 80. A higher diastolic pressure, that is above 80, was associated with more strokes and or hospitalization for heart failure, and if it was greater than 90, for myocardial infarction. Now, if the patients had a low diastolic pressure, that is less than 70, they also had a higher risk, 1.29 hazard ratio for all-cause outcomes. Myocardial infarction, the hazard ratio is 1.54, hospitalization for heart failure 1.81, all-cause death hazard ratio of about 1.2. There was no signal with this lower diastolic pressure for stroke or cardiovascular death. So the authors concluded that compared to a diastolic of 70 to 80, both a higher and a lower diastolic pressure was associated with more significant cardiovascular outcomes. And it certainly does lead us to think about when we're treating hypertension, we're targeting the systolic pressure. This is in all the risk markers. And I was taught many years ago that after the age of 55, it's your systolic pressure that primarily drives the risk of stroke, heart failure, etc. But we currently sort of ignore the diastolic pressure, and we're all aware of studies that show these patients that have very low diastolic pressures appear to have higher risk. Hopefully, further trials and science will guide us in terms of saying, is there a boundary of diastolic pressure below which I should not go, even if it means allowing for a slightly higher systolic pressure, for example? I thought it was a very interesting paper, and it doesn't give us firm answers, but I think it's interesting for us to consider as we manage these patients. And certainly when I see a patient in my practice who's got a fairly good systolic pressure, a diastolic pressure of 60 or even less, and they're lightheaded, I'm really thinking twice about whether to push harder on the systolic target. So the third article was also in JACC. It's entitled Infective Endocarditis in Patients with Bicuspid Aortic Valve or Mitral Valve Prolapse. Now, you're all aware that many, many years ago, we routinely prophylaxed patients with BAV or MVP prior to dental work and other procedures to try to prevent endocarditis. And then the guideline changed, and the recommendation was that endocarditis prophylaxis primarily related to patients who not only were thought to be at risk for endocarditis, but significant complications of that endocarditis. This article came from a study in Spain, 3,200 consecutive patients who were seen in a registry of 31 Spanish hospitals with endocarditis. They were classified as high-risk endocarditis patients. That was about 1,200 patients. Also lower moderate-risk endocarditis patients, and that was about 1,800. There were 54 patients with BAV and 89 patients with mitral valve prolapse. And there were several very interesting observations. First, bicuspid valve and mitral valve patients had a higher incidence of Viridens group streptococci than did the high-risk group and the low and moderate-risk groups together. Also, a similar pattern was seen for infective endocarditis from a suspected origin in the teeth. Again, BAV and mitral valve patients had more of that. And finally, mitral valve patients and bicuspid valve patients had more intracardiac complications than patients in the low to moderate risk group. In fact, it was similar to the, quote, high risk group that we currently recommend prophylaxis for. So the conclusions of the authors was that BAV and mitral valve prolapse are associated with strep viridans fairly frequently and infections presumably coming from odontologic or teeth origin, and that the complication rates were similar to the group of, quote, high-risk patients that were currently recommended to provide endocarditis prophylaxis for based on current guidelines. Now, ever since the most recent guidelines were put out, there's been this debate. People have argued that since a lot of endocarditis is staphylococcus, that the previous recommendations for antibiotics didn't cover that anyway. This article, though, I think is a really interesting paper. And it certainly raises questions about whether we should consider mitral valve prolapse and or bicuspid aortic valve as being higher risk conditions that should receive endocarditis prophylaxis. Now, it's ironic. I remember as a house officer many years ago seeing patients with endocarditis after dental procedures. And of course, we had this momentum then to provide endocarditis prophylaxis to all these people. And then, of course, we stopped seeing them. And the question is, did we stop seeing them because we were successful in our treatment, or was it not indicated in the first place? And of course, we're all aware of the worry about creating resistant organisms by using antibiotics in patients who don't need them. I don't have a final answer, but I thought this paper was interesting. And certainly in my patients who have structurally very abnormal mitral valves or aortic valves with either mitral valve prolapse or bicuspid valve, I have had a discussion with the patient about the pros and cons of endocarditis prophylaxis and try to make it an individual decision. Well, I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. You can find these articles and their journal scans on the American College of Cardiology's website. Find us online or wherever you get your podcasts. And until next week, I hope you have a great week. Thank you.